Thank you. My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
This is, I love this format. It's really great to get a blabbermouth like me to just come and speak for like an hour straight over a series of weeks. It's like, how could I resist, you know? And, you know, I just love talking about the big book, the 12-step process, what I was like, what happened to me, what I'm like now. And it's like there's so much to talk about. I think the last 2 weeks we really kind of, or at least I spoke about the first 4 steps, you know, pretty in detail. I'd like to try and get through my experience with the rest of them. I'm not going to do a lot of reading out of a book. I'm just going to talk to you about my experience and, you know, some of the passages in the book that really were meaningful to me. And this part is like the part that's, you know, it's not about the drinking anymore. You know, this is about what's the underlying causes that predate the drinking? What are the underlying causes that lead back to the drinking? Like, that's really, you know, what the issue is. And so I told you about my first foray into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked up on the shades and I read the steps for the first time, and I saw that some of them seemed like they would be kind of easy, or, you know, I could see myself doing them, but there were two that I knew I would never do for sure, and those 2 steps were 5 and 9. I was not going to sit and talk to somebody about my life and tell them about me, and I don't even know so much at that time if I understood why. I understand why now. But I was really afraid of that. And there's a line in the big book when it talks about step, when you get to into action, right, that chapter, and it starts talking about step 5, there's a line that says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. You know, he has this stage character, this actor that he presents to the world. That's the person I want you to think I am. I want to enjoy a certain reputation, but deep down in my heart, I know I don't deserve it. Like, it talks about this idea that I've been living this double life, and I wasn't really aware of that. Like, I wasn't so sure I knew who I was, but I had this feeling that whatever that thing was, if you knew what it was, you wouldn't like it. Because I don't think I liked it, you know? And I wasn't clear about this. This was not stuff that I was clear about. It was very murky, and I didn't want to investigate it. I didn't want to look at it because it was scary to me. I remember as a kid, I would hear, I think it was my grandfather who would say something like, never trust somebody that doesn't look you in the eyes. And I remember for a long time, I couldn't look people in the eyes. Like, I couldn't do it. And you shouldn't trust me. You know, back then, you should not have trusted me. And it was just like, I felt like there was something about me that if you looked in here and you saw it, you'd know it. And what was hard about that is, like, you would know something that I didn't know. You'd be clued into something that I wasn't clued into. And that was really the predicament that I was in. And so I don't want to sit and have a conversation with somebody about what's really going on, who I am. My whole life I've been, like, when I tell somebody a story, the details of the story were always very well managed so that I could be painted in a certain light, right? That's how I live my life. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think I need to tell you in order for me to extract from you whatever it is I think I want to get from you. And I've been doing that all the time, and I didn't know that. And then there was later on when I started to look at what was happening in step 5, I had this realization. I have a memory from when I was a kid. I'm one of 5, and I have 2 older brothers and an older sister. So in the pecking order, that means, you know, you're kind of screwed, right? And they had the ability to push my buttons at will, whenever they wanted. And, you know, you've heard that one where they say, well, your family knows how to push your buttons because they installed them, you know, that one. And so they had that ability, and I would get so angry. You know, and when you're a kid and you have older kids above you, it's like there's really not much you can do about that. And at one point, my mother said something like, you know, if you stopped acting like that bothered you, they'd get bored and leave you alone. Something like that. And you know what? That's right. That's true. If you stop acting like stuff bothers you, if you hold it in, if you hide who you are, if you don't let people know, you don't let people in, they can't touch you. Because they get bored, you know. The excitement is like poking the monkey. I want to get a reaction from the bear. But if you don't give them a reaction, they stop. And so I learned that lesson at a very early age. And you know, I always learned all the wrong lessons. And that became one of my tools in life. Even though I didn't really know that that was a tool, but that became a tool in my life for the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, 30 years, whatever it was. And every year, I would get better and better at keeping people out. And I didn't. And this was unconscious. Again, like this is not something I was aware of as it was happening. And the result of doing that, it was tantamount to I was building up a wall around myself. And every year that wall was getting higher and it was getting thicker. And I was very good at keeping people out. But the unintended consequence of that is this intense loneliness. Like I can keep you out, but I'm also locked in. Like that's the unintended consequence. And what that felt like, and I heard it described, I didn't know what this was until I came to AA. And what that was like, what I heard people say was like, I'm in a room full of people, but I feel like I'm completely alone. And I went, oh my God, I feel like that sometimes, you know? Or like I would be with, you know, my family, the people that I'm closest with, and I love them, and I know they love me, and I'm with them, but I feel like we're on two totally different planets. Like I don't connect, and I don't know why. And I'm in relationships with people, and like I want to say something, you know, like about how I felt, and it was like I can't get the words out of my mouth, and I don't know why. Like I just don't know why I'm like that, and that's how I'm walking around through the world, and the result is. Like my relationships were always just chaotic, a mess. I was always at odds with people, always banging heads. I was the guy that I was. I always felt like I only did stuff to you to get even with what you did to me. I was like a big scorekeeper, and that's how I was living my life. So you put all that together, I come into AA. And they tell me that, you know, well, yeah, step five is sit with somebody and tell them everything. And I'm like, no, thank you. I don't want to do that. I would do anything to keep from doing something like that. And I think I told you, maybe it was week one, where I said, you know, that first guy that spoke to me at that meeting, when I told him after the meeting, I said, I read the steps. There's two that I definitely can't do, 5 and 9. He said, well, don't worry about it. You're 5 steps and 9 steps away from there. By the time you get there, maybe you'll change your mind. And I said, you can do that? And he said, yeah. I said, okay. And so I started, I just kind of put that stuff out of my mind. And by the time I got to step 5, I was convinced enough that you guys knew like what you were talking about, that I was willing to do this. And I was really, like I had these fears, like I imagined my sponsor getting drunk after my 5th step. I imagined him, he gets drunk, and now he's on my street, outside my house, letting everybody who will listen know, you know what he did? You know, like that's the fear in my head of like, you know, what can happen. Because, you know, I also come from a family where you don't get your business out there in the street. You know, button it up. So I do it, and I would say my first 4th and 5th step, I've gone through the steps many times. I believe that the 12 steps, and this is just, you know, from my lineage, you know, the people that I've worked with and that I respect, and I was always told, you know, the 12 steps aren't something you just do once. You know, it's something you should do periodically. You should go through the steps periodically whenever you feel like you need to. So I've been through the steps multiple times. And the first 4th and 5th step, by today's standards, like my standards today, were like pathetic. You know, they weren't like, I wasn't completely and totally and thoroughly honest. I don't think, I wasn't capable of being completely and totally and thoroughly honest at that time. But I was as honest as I could be at that time. And that 4th step that I wrote, I did it to the best of my ability at that time. Mm-hmm. And listen, that was enough to keep this thing going. And over time, I've had 4th and 5th steps that like blew me away. What was revealed to me about myself, about how petty I can be, about the stuff that bothers me, the stuff that gets under my skin, the stuff I never wanted to admit to anybody. And I had this big thing of like, we talk about shame, guilt, and remorse, coming into the rooms with shame, guilt, and remorse. And I had this sense of embarrassment that the things that bothered me, they bothered me. Like, I should be too cool for that to bother me. Like, I don't want you to know that this kind of stuff bothers me. And it's so important for me to be able to have at least one person in the world where I can say, you know what the truth is? I'm petty. And that bothers me. And I'm really torn up about it. And I can't get it out of my head. Like, I need to be able to say stuff like that to somebody. You know, sometimes when we get time, it's almost embarrassing to think, like, I think I should be past that now. You know, I shouldn't have those kinds of feelings now. And so these two steps, 4 and 5, were the beginning of getting honest with myself and honest with somebody else. And another way of looking at it was like the beginning of chipping away at the walls that I had put around myself. And I just had to get out of that self-made prison that started with me. And then we get to, 6 and 7, or I got to 6 and 7, and everybody, if you're a big book person, 6 and 7 in the big book is like, a paragraph and a prayer. There's not a lot to it. They make it seem like it's so simple, like you just, here's a paragraph, here's a prayer, done, good for the rest of your life. And my experience has been 6 and 7 is like this whole program. 6 and 7 is about like this idea that underneath the drinking, underneath everything else, there are these character defects, or this way of thinking that I have that's rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness. It's rooted in fear, and I can't seem to shake it. And those things will manifest in my life, in my actions and my deeds. Like, well, how does my fear manifest in my life? And fill in the blank. Take a look at your own life, right? I took a look at my life. Fear would manifest in my life. Like, I can't let you know that I'm afraid. So a lot of times fear would show up as anger. I'm an angry dude. I'm gonna scream, and I'm gonna yell, and that's my way of camouflaging that really I'm afraid. I didn't know that. In relationships, I'm afraid that you're going to get me before I got to get you. So I got to get you first. I'm going to one-up you. I'm going to stab you in the back. I'm like, you ever hear the one where they say the difference between an alcoholic and an addict is an alcoholic steals your money and then, drunkenly admits that they did it, and the drug addict steals your money and then helps you look for it. I'm both those guys. I steal your stuff and then I'm trying to pretend, oh yeah, let's find out who did it. It was me. In step 7, this idea of humility, I didn't come in here with any real knowledge of humility. Like, I'm not a humble person. And humility started out with, and I'm still not a very humble person, but I'm more humble than I was. I'm very aware of the fact that I can't do this on my own. I'm very aware of the fact that if I try to live my life where I'm the captain of my own ship, I make all my own decisions, I don't have any real spirituality, I don't have a community of people, I don't have a sponsor. If I just go it alone, I'm doomed to failure. I'm aware of that. Like, my experience abundantly confirms that that's what happens to me when I try to go out alone. I've done that enough. And I think there's some humility in that. There's humility in the fact that I know I can't get rid of my character defects. Like, I can't use myself to fix myself. Right? Like, using self to fix self is like trying to use the problem to fix the problem. Right? Like, you can't use the problem to fix the problem. That would be a problem, using the problem to fix the problem. Well, using self to fix self, that's what that is. I'm using the problem to try and fix the problem. And that's why this program is all about a spirituality that is meaningful for each one of us, right? Whatever the higher power is of your understanding, that's all you need. The idea that there's something that you can tap into that can do for you what you can't do for yourself. Like, that's beautiful stuff. And then you get into the other step that I told you that I wasn't ever going to be able to do. And I'm going to kind of linger on this one for a little bit because I think it's really important. The step that I really didn't think I would do, and I was like adamant that I wasn't going to do it, probably is one of the most freeing steps in my experience for me. So like steps 8 and 9, you know, coming to this conclusion that I've done a lot of damage in my life and I owe people amends. I've harmed people and I need to go to them and try and set it right. And that scared the hell out of me. Going to somebody and saying I was wrong, that I took money from you. What about people that were happily unaware of the fact that I ever did anything to them? I got to go to them? I'm not doing that. I did a lot of stupid things to a lot of people. And it was kind of like it wasn't fair because I felt like if I knew this was what was going to happen, I never would have did that stuff. You know, I felt like I hadn't done anything to anyone that they didn't have it coming to them. That was my mentality. And AA said, no, that's not the way this works. You're going to have to go and make amends. If you want to get free, that's what you're going to have to do. So I would say for me and my the sponsorship that I got, one of the most important things about going to make the amends was when I went to somebody to make the amends, I had to tell them like what I was aware of, like how I had harmed you. And then I had to ask you, how that made you feel, and I also had to ask you, is there anything that I missed or anything I left out? And in my experience, a lot of times there were a lot of people that were just wanted to get this thing through. Like they're like, you know what, you've done great. Just go with the Lord, go in peace and love to serve the Lord. Like we're good. But there were a couple times where people said to me some things that I wasn't aware of. Yeah, because I think I know how I harm people. And one of the ones that sticks out for me is with my brother, my oldest brother. And I asked him that question. I said, is there anything I missed? And he said, well, yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. And I wasn't expecting him to tell me something. He goes, I'll tell you something. He goes, I had to have a conversation with Mom. And I had to let her know that she should give up on you the way I had given up on you, because it was only a matter of time before we were going to get that phone call that you were dead. And I remember when he said that to me, it hit me like, it was like a gut punch, you know, like I wasn't expecting that. And when I thought about like what he told me, it was like, imagine putting someone in the position where they have to tell your mother to give up on you because you're a lost cause, because there's nothing that we can do to help this kid, and you might as well accept it like I have. And that's where he had gotten with me, watching what I was doing, experiencing my alcoholism in the family life. And you go, geez, what do you do? What do you do with something like that? When somebody says something like that to you. And my oldest brother, man, we did not see eye to eye. We had a lot of problems in my active alcoholism. And what's crazy is since that amends, how much our relationship has changed. You know, I always had a chip on my shoulder about him. He was the older brother, so I always wanted to knock him down a few pegs, like I was the bratty younger brother. And our relationship is like he moved down to Virginia Beach years ago. And every year I go down there, and when I go there, I'm in his house. And we spend time together, and it's just a completely different thing. And it's almost as if, it's weird, it's almost as if all that other stuff, all that damage that had happened before, it's almost as if it never happened. That's crazy. Another amends that was really significant for me, and I think for me the family amends were like very significant. One that was really significant for me was with my father. Now, when I was 9 years old, my father, he got arrested and he went to prison, and this was his third time going to prison. And at that time there was a law called the Rockefeller Law, And so it was like a three strikes, you're out law. So he got an automatic 20 years when I was 9. And I just remember how angry I was about how this guy ruined my life. I mean, I like when that thing happened, when my father went to prison, that happened to me. I didn't care about how it affected anybody else or what they thought about it or what they were. It happened to me. And I didn't care about the fact that he was the one that was going to be doing 20 years. I got chipped. This guy, he did whatever he did. Now he's gone. Now for the next 20 years, I don't have a dad, and I got chipped. I was an angry kid. And so when he finally got out, obviously it was, you know, it was 20 years later, and I was in the rooms of AA. And one of the things that had happened while he was still in was I had gotten into a car accident while driving under the influence, and my car was wrecked, and I was like, I didn't have money to get any of this stuff repaired or anything, and I was beside myself and I was really angry. And my father had called me from prison, and I happened to be, you know, right when it was happening. And we were having a conversation. I was telling him how, you know, mad I was and everything else. And so he said to me, he goes, "Hey, listen," he goes, do you need money? I can send you money." I go, "You don't have this kind of money." And he goes, I have money socked away. And if you need it, tell me, I'll send it to you. You can pay me back when you get it." That part I forgot. You know, that's the part when he said that part was like, didn't happen. He said, I'll send you the money. And I said, "Well, yeah, that's it. Okay, that works." And then he sent the money, and I used that money. And in my mind, I thought, I'm never paying that money back. Like, you know, that's the least he can do for me. You know, like with what he did, remember, this is how my mindset, what he did to me by going to prison for 20 years, oh, it's the least you can do. You're not getting that money back ever. And I promptly forgot I ever got that money from him. So now when he got out, right, a little while had passed. He's trying to get himself back on his feet. And one day he calls me and he says, "Hey, listen, do you remember that money I loaned you? Do you think maybe I can get it back? I need to, you know," he was trying to put something together. And man, I was so indignant. I was like, "Are you kidding me? I don't have that." I mean, I'm like, the audacity that this guy could even ask me for this money back. Like, are you kidding me? I was very indignant, and basically the way I reacted, it was designed to make him never ask for that money again, and he never did. Right? And that was, and I figured I solved that problem. And I'm never going to think about it again. So one of the times I'm going through the steps again, and I'm going through the steps, and I get to step 8 and 9, and I'm going through, you know, what do I need to do? There were a couple other 8th and 9th steps that happened that I never even thought about it. And I'm going through this 8th and 9th, and all of a sudden, that memory pops into my head. And I said, I gotta pay him back, right? Now at this point, my father has Parkinson's, and he's in a home being taken care of, and I'm like, I gotta go give him the money back. So I go to him, and I do the whole thing that, you know, we do, and I made my approach, and I said, you know, and I said what I need to say, and I said, and I don't have all of it now, but I'd like to, you know, make a payment plan. And he said, "Listen, you don't have to do it." And I said, "No, I do have to do it. I do have to do it." And then he said, "Okay, well, if you're going to do it," he was still shady at this point. He didn't want the government to know he had any money. So he goes, "All right, if you're going to do it, don't send it to me. Send it to my older sister, and she'll put it away for me." And I said, "Done, you got it." So I made a repeating payment plan. That just, I once I made it, right, through my electronic banking, set all the parameters, and then I never thought about it again, right? And I was like, that's great, you know, like, one more done. Now, when my father, you know, a couple years later, he came to the end, and I remember I was sitting in his bed, I was sitting in his room, and he was, you know, he's in his deathbed, and we knew he was going, and he was now, he was not conscious, so you couldn't really have a conversation with him. You know, we would talk, and they said maybe he can hear you, but there was no, you know, back and forth dialogue. And I'm sitting in that room, and, you know, when you're in a situation like that, a lot of emotions and thoughts will go through your head. And I was sitting in that room, and I was thinking, like, did I do enough? You know, like he's going, and did I really make amends? Like, did I do all I could to try and make things right between us? Because, you know, one of the things that I was hoping for in a lot of my amends, but specifically in that one, was I was hoping that when I made amends, you know, somehow I would be able to create some relationship that I always had in my head with him. You know, like, I never got to have the relationship with my father that I would have liked to have, you know. And so I'm sitting in the room, and he passes, and I'm praying. And then me and my brothers and sisters, we come together, and we start having the conversation about, well, now what are we going to do as far as, you know, taking care of, you know, the end part. And my one brother says, well, let's all chip in. Well, you know, whatever it is, we'll all chip in, and we'll just do it that way. And then my sister says, she says, we don't have to do that. See, we don't all have to chip in. He actually has that money, so we're good. And everybody's like, okay. And we go to walk away, and I go, wait a second. And I turn around, and I go to my sister, and I go, when you say that he has the money to take care of the arrangements, are you talking about the money that I sent you? And she goes, oh yeah, that's right, that's the money that you sent me, and it takes care of everything. And it was in that moment where I was like, oh my God, like, I had been sending that money, like, on good faith, and it was, and it's not like a big deal, it's not like some white light moment. But there was something about that, there was like symmetry in it, where I realized, like, I had doubt on whether I had done the right thing or I had done enough, and I felt like it was, like, my higher power was going, you did it. You did what you needed to do, and you did it. And I walked out of there, like, I walked from that experience feeling like I was clean with him. And that's my experience, like, with 8 and 9, is, like, I'm trying to get clean from my past. I mean, I did a lot of things to harm people, and I'm trying the best I can to try and make it right. And then the last thing I'll talk about with 8 and 9 is I had a lot of financial amends, and I had to go to a lot of people and make terms with them, and be like, okay, this is what I owe you. I don't have it all. I'm going to make a payment plan. Is that acceptable to you? And the weird thing was, as I was going to people and making terms with them, and I was making those amends, it was weird, like, these opportunities would open up for me. Like, somebody would call me up and they would say, hey, I need somebody to do whatever, and it pays whatever. And the weird thing was, like, whatever, like, they were paying was, like, usually just, like, a little bit more than what I just paid out. It was weird like that. And I was like, that's weird. If that happens like once or twice, it's like, all right, it's a weird coincidence. But it happened like a lot of times. I made a lot of amends, and like almost every one of them, I'd make the amends, and then like an opportunity would open up, and it was like a door would open. And I started to get this idea in my head that maybe I could make a business out of it, you know, like, you know, like there's something here, you know, but you can't do that. So, but these opportunities would open up, and I got put in a position where I saw that I could possibly, I could see myself in a different line of work because of the opportunities that showed up for me. It was very weird. And my experience up until that point was I was in a career that I could make a living and pay my bills, but I had no passion for it anymore. I just was like completely, it was like dead. It was like you wake up on Monday and you're like, oh my God. And you drag your corpse out of the bed and you go to work and you just hate it. And then Friday comes and you finally wake up and you're happy that it's the weekend because the week sucked because you do something you don't like. Like, I was in that place. And it was like a dead place to be. And I started to see, because of these opportunities that happened as a result of like 8 and 9, I started to see this glimmer that maybe I could like do something else. Maybe I could be in a different career altogether. And it wasn't like anything solid. Like, it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, the clouds parted and I was in a new career. But that whole experience actually led to me changing careers in a really dramatic way. And I mean, I'm just one of these people, I feel very fortunate because I do something that I love today. Like, I don't wake up on Mondays going, oh my God, I gotta do this. I wake up and I'm like, I get to do this. And I'm invigorated and I feel like what I do actually matters and it gives purpose and meaning to my life and it helps other people. I mean, it's crazy. And as a result of changing directions like that, that also afforded me the opportunity to, you know, go back to school and get like go back for my master's. I had my bachelor's, and you know, I was one of those people. You ever hear like people come to the they come up to the front of the room, they tell their story, and they talk about all these blessings in their life and all these things that happen, and you go, you know, that sounds great for you, but that could never happen for me. You know, like, I felt like that a lot of times when I'd hear people talk about the things that they were able to do as a result of recovery, like going back to school or changing careers or, you know, buying whatever it is that they bought and how their lives were so miraculously better, and you go, yeah, that's great for you, but I don't have the ability to do that. I don't have the money to do that. I don't have the time to do that. I'm not smart enough. I'm not this enough. I'm not that enough. Like, I had that stuff in my head. And the weird thing was, like, the 12 steps, like, actually being earnest about the steps and being rigorously honest as I could be about the steps and really taking it seriously, I found myself in these positions where opportunity showed up, a door would appear, it would open up, and I would walk through. And I didn't know how it was going to work out. I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it happen or whatever. But I just had faith that, you know what, this is happening, and I'm just going to walk through it. And a series of those events happened, and it led to, like, the life I have today. It's amazing. Like, I really would, like, I would tell you probably my life, the way it is right now, is the way it is right now almost solely based on steps 8 and 9, like the changes that happened in my life as far as circumstances. Being willing to make amends to people and being willing to pay back whatever I need to pay back, to own up to whatever I need to own up to have the tough conversations with people, all of those things that I was willing to do had like these, like they were incremental changes in my attitude and my perspective that eventually had a dramatic change in my life. It's crazy. And I never would have guessed it would have like went this way. You know, I didn't know how it was going to work out. So 8 and 9, usually a huge change in my life because of 8 and 9. And then you get to step 10 in the book. And if you read step 10 in the book, what you realize is step 10 is like all the other steps together, like every day, right? That's basically step 10. And it's weird. It's kind of like, it reminds me of this really old movie that probably no one in here has ever seen. It's called The Karate Kid. But I'm not talking about the remake. I'm talking about the old one with... Ralph Macchio, or Pat Morita, I think that was his name, right? So Ralph plays Danielson, right? He's like a good Jersey boy, and he goes out with his mother to California. Does anybody see that movie? Yeah. Okay, so you know that, right? So Danielson goes to California, and when he gets there, nobody likes him. You know, he's having trouble. And he gets beat up, he gets bullied, and he wants to, you know, be able to defend himself and, you know, be, I don't know, like, have a better life. And he meets Mr. Miyagi, who he hears knows karate, and he wants him to teach him karate. And so Mr. Miyagi says yes, and he says, first lesson, you know, what is it? Wax on, wax off, or sand the boards, or you know, paint the fence. He gives them like three different things, and Ralph Macchio, he goes, okay, he does the wax on, wax off for like a whole day. He waxes all his cars, comes back the next day, and he goes, okay, now sand the floor. Right, and Ralph Macchio or Danielson is like really annoyed. He's like, this guy's a fraud. Like, what the hell? I asked him to teach me karate, and he's got me doing these stupid chores. And then he goes, okay, done with that, come back tomorrow. He comes back tomorrow, okay, paint the fence. And finally he goes, I've had it. You're a fraud. I asked you to teach me karate and you got me doing your chores. Like, what the hell? And then you saw the movie, so you know what happens, right? Mr. Miyagi says, block my punches. And all of a sudden Danielson realizes that he was, you know, all of that menial stuff that he was doing was actually, there was a method to the madness. He was teaching him something without him really realizing he was teaching him something. Like, he was learning the fundamentals. And I feel like that's what happens in the first 9 steps, is like we're learning the fundamentals and we get really annoyed with our sponsor when they say, you know, okay, pray, all right, write inventory, okay, read your inventory, okay, pray, okay, make amends. And it feels like you're being told, you know, wax on, wax off. Like, what is all this stuff? What is this stuff? Where are we going with this? You know, you might even have one of those sponsors that even beyond that, he's saying, get a coffee commitment, be the greeter. It's just stupid. Like, they're all stupid ideas. Call somebody, call people. And you go, this is so, like, this means nothing. You're a fraud. And then what happens when you get to step 10 is you find out that, you know, you've been doing all those things for a while and you've learned, like, you know, karate. You know, you've learned how to put all these things together. Now you could use these different tools in conjunction with each other on an everyday basis. That's crazy. And then by the time you get to step 10, they also have the step 10 promises. And they say by this time, sanity will have returned. Right? By this time, you're not going to be thinking about picking up a drink. You're not going to be obsessing with the insane idea about how do I get loaded? How do I get out of here? How do I do this? How do I do that? And like, if you look at those 10 step promises, how many of us would, like, I'd sign up for that in a minute when I'm brand new, just to get some freedom from that obsessive thought to pick up. I mean, I couldn't shake it. It seemed like it lasted for months. I remember early days of my sobriety date is January 1st of 2007, and I remember, I don't know, maybe the first 4, 5, 6 months of 2007, every day, that's what I thought about. I felt like, you know, you ever see the cartoon where they have the pianos hanging by a string, and you know it's going to drop at some point right on somebody's head? And that's what it felt like. It felt like every day I had the piano on a string following me around, and at some point it's going to land on my head, and that's going to be me getting drunk and screwing up my life again. And I can't seem to... And it felt like there was nothing I could do to stop this from happening. That was a horrible existence. And step 10 is talking about, yeah, that will be gone. You know? You get to this point, and you're going to find, like, it seems as though the problem's been removed. Right? Wow. That's crazy stuff. And then right from 10, they go into step 11, this idea of improving my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. I've learned the basics of like a spirituality in the first 10 steps. And step 11 gives me the permission to deepen that in whatever way I need to. Like, it's really like choose your own adventure. What works for you? Do you like the church that you grew up with? If you say yes, great. Go back there. If you say no, great. Do something else. It says, hey, there's inspirational books. Go read them. He says, God populated this world with many ministers and doctors. Make use of them. And it talks about in step 11, this idea, it gives us like three real tools. It talks about nightly review, when I retire at night, right? How did I do? Talks about upon awakening, right? Think about the 24 hours ahead. It's like a meditation. And then it talks about the pause. As I go through the day, when I'm agitated or doubtful, I can pause, right? Just pause things. I don't have to react. So one of the things that happened in my life was I was one of those people that if the thought if the thought rose in my head, it had to come out of my mouth. I could not self-edit. I was just like vomiting on people. You know what you should do? All that stuff. And I can't tell you how many times a thought comes up into my head and I go, yeah, you're not saying that. Don't say that. Don't say that one. And you know, that is helpful. That is really helpful. I don't have to say everything that occurs to me. That's great. It's a great tool. It'll save you a lot of heartache, that's for sure. So, all right, so now you got 10 and 11, and, you know, for me, I would say that step 11 was the step that I had the biggest quantum move forward on when I really took step 11 seriously, meaning like I took meditation seriously. And what happened basically is there was a speaker that I loved listening to his tapes. I mean, just like the way he spoke and the things he talked about, they just hit me. And he always talked about how important meditation was for him. And I would listen to his talks, and I knew I definitely wasn't doing what he said he was doing, like not doing that. And I wanted what he had. And so I started getting this idea that I've got to find a way to start meditating. And so I started trying to. And I don't know if anybody's here has ever tried to start meditating, but God, it's so, when you first start, it's so hard. I couldn't sit for like a minute. You know, I would sit down and I'd say, okay, I'm meditating. I wonder what I'm going to eat tonight. Oh wait, the Yankee game's on tonight, isn't it? Oh my God, that's right. Oh, they're playing the Red Sox. Oh, okay. Maybe what I'll do is I'm gonna get an eggplant parm from Nona's, and then I'm gonna put on the game. And then wait a second, I'm supposed to be meditating. Oh, back to meditation. And then 3 seconds later, it's what am I gonna do tomorrow? Right, and that was my experience. Like my mind was just completely all over the place. And you go, well, how am I going to meditate with that? You know, like, how do you meditate with that? And there was, you've heard this one where they say when the student's ready, the teacher appears, right? There was a guy that I was friendly with. I knew he was a Brooklyn guy. And one day we were talking, and for the first time I realized when I was talking to him that he was big into meditation, like huge, like he was a meditation teacher. I said, I didn't know that. And I just started asking him questions. And then the next thing I knew, he and I started doing some work together, and he was showing me different types of meditations, different styles that you could use, different, you know, techniques. And I went from the guy who I couldn't do it for 2 minutes to, I'd go 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I was doing, at one point, I'm not doing this now, but at one point I was doing 40 minutes in the morning and 40 minutes in the afternoon, and it was like crazy the effect that had on me. Like, I was so calm. Like, I felt like unshakable. Like, whatever happened, I was like, okay, all right. It was the craziest thing, and it was all due to the fact that I was willing to try
meditation and try and take it seriously. And the same thing with nightly review. I would go and I would email my nightly reviews to my sponsor. I would email it to other people, and we had spiritual consent with each other, and we would say, this is what I struggle with. This is what you, and I saw it's the same stuff with me. I have a friend in the rooms. His name is David, and he was famous for saying this statement. He would say, "Every day in AA is like Halloween." And he would say that, and I would always go, like I knew what he was talking about. And one day he said it, and I said to myself, what the hell is he saying when he says that? Every day in AA is Halloween. So I said, you know what? Instead of just wondering, let me ask. Because that's my thing. I'll pretend like I know, and never ask, because I can't let you know that I don't know. So I go, David, I have to know, what do you mean when you say that? Every day in AA is Halloween. Like, I'm thinking he means, like, you go to the AA meeting and you got gremlins and goblins and witches and, people who are in ill repute, And he said, well, it's every day in AA is like Halloween, is like my alcoholism or my defects will show up at my door every day wearing a different mask, ding dong, trick or treat. But it's always the same thing. It's always my illness, but it will look different. I said, oh, I like that. Because that's the kind of how it happens for me too. It's the same stuff. It keeps coming up. It just looks different. Take away the person, take away the event, and it's like, I'm mad at you for the same thing. It's weird. I'm like, I get mad at people for doing things that I do all the time. Isn't that weird? I think they call that hypocrisy, right? I'm a hypocrite, right? I'm mad at you because you did what I did just last night to you. Weird. I have a sponsee who I was working with, and we're doing his going through his amends, and he was angry at his sister for taking the family inheritance, the money, and I can't forgive him. And he had to go to make amends to his son because he stole his son's lawsuit money, tens of thousands of dollars. And I said, isn't that weird? You're going to go to your son and ask for forgiveness, but you don't want to forgive your sister for doing the same thing you did to your son. Isn't that weird? He goes, yeah, that is weird. I go, join the club. You're just like me, right? I get angry at people for doing things that I do all the time. And so the first 11 steps, they prepared me to turn around and start helping other people. Which is the other thing I never really wanted to do. I didn't really want to be of service to other people. I'm very selfish and self-centered. I don't want to be thinking about you. I don't want to have a conversation with you about what's going on in your life. I don't care. Now, if you want to help me, on the other hand, well, that's a different story. I'm willing to accept your help. But please don't ask me for help. I don't want to do it. Right? That's how I felt when I came into AA. And then those first 11 steps, they changed something inside of me. And they made me want to give back. And in different ways too, the sponsorship for sure, leading meetings, speaking at meetings, making coffee, being a greeter, getting involved with general service, being a GSR, being a DCM. I mean, just getting involved in all these things. And everything that I got involved in with AA as far as service was concerned, they were all blessings in my life. Like, they've given me the ability to become a different person. I have plenty of thoughts that are off the wall and crazy and not very nice, but I can see today that I am not my thoughts, right? That I don't have to live my life based on, well, I think this, so then, well. This program has given me the ability to, despite whatever goes through my mind, I have a way to deal with it. I have a way to deal with my life, no matter what curveball gets thrown at me. The service shows up in, I'm sitting across the table from a person, and we're going through their steps, and we're going through the book, and I'm looking basically at a reflection of me. You know, like the person that I'm working with is just like another version of me. The difference between us is like I'm on the other side of an experience that they haven't had yet. But I identify with that person. Like I remember being in their shoes and not knowing if this thing would really work. I mean, the one that tugs at my heart is the guy that goes, he goes, please, he said, just tell me if this will really work or not. Because I can't take it if I do all this work and then it doesn't work. Like, I can't. And I identify with that so much. Like, dude, if I go and do this work, it's gotta work. Because if it doesn't, I can't take it. And you know what happened for me is like I did this work and it worked. What do we say in AA? It works if you work it. Right? So work it. You're worth it or something like that, right? Anyway, that brings me to the end of the hour, brings me to the end of the 3 weeks. I'm really happy that I got a chance to come here and talk to you guys about my experience with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps and the spirituality that I found in it. And I'd love to hear what you guys have to say. Thank you.